Welcome to this episode of On The Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. In each episode, we speak to various professionals and experts to gain insight into legal careers, law school, and other exciting developments in the world of law. Without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome back to LSE's On The Case podcast. My name is Miriam and I am the head of LSE Law Society's Pro Bono Division, one of the five divisions in the Society that works to execute our vision of increasing students' awareness and accessibility to the legal system and legal sector. Today, we are joined by Hayley Campbell, a U.S. qualified associate working in the Pro Bono Department of Hogan Lovells here in London and an executive committee member of the Human Rights Lawyers Association. Before Hogan Lovells, Hayley undertook her LLB and LLM in Scotland and worked as a research analyst at the Royal United Services Institute. In this episode, we will explore a wide range of topics from pro bono and commercial law firms to Hayley's career as a human rights lawyer to ways you can get involved. But most importantly, we hope that you will see through this episode how many pro bono opportunities there are and how pro bono is truly and should be for everyone. Hi, Hayley. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's get started. I think I would assume most of the people who listen to our podcast would have an understanding of what pro bono is. But for those who don't know, could you give us a brief introduction on what pro bono is and why it's so important in today's context?
Absolutely. So pro bono is a provision of free legal services to those who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford legal representation. And we have quite a large pro bono practice here at the commercial firm where I work. So it's a way for law firms to contribute to society, so the wider society, help with access to justice, rule of law, helping social enterprises. And I think it's very important right now because we've seen over the last, 15 years, just the provision of legal aid, it's getting worse and worse. And you aren't entitled to it for so many issues that you were before. And the number of people who are eligible for legal aid has really dwindled. So I think it's important for firms to have pro bono practices and for lawyers to undertake pro bono in order to ensure that those out there can get legal representation when they need it.
For sure. And I think especially with the whole pandemic going on and now we have another war that's happening, legal aid and access to the legal system is more dire than ever. And pro bono work is, as you mentioned, incredibly important. So moving on a bit to Hogan Lovells itself, I think when a lot of us think about pro bono, or at least when I first starting to understand what pro bono is and the types of institutions and people that undertake this work, I think a lot of us instinctively think of human rights firms and chambers, nonprofits and international organizations. But actually, we see that a lot of large scale commercial firms like Hogan Lovells are actually making significant pro bono contributions. And this is something that law firms are increasingly placing an emphasis on. Could you tell us a little bit more about Hogan Lovells' pro bono practice, its history and where it is now, just in brief terms?
Absolutely. So we have quite a long history here at Hogan Lovells. I think my boss, Yasmin, she has been a pro bono, she started as a pro bono associate about 27 years ago. And I believe that we were the first firm in London, at least, to have a dedicated pro bono lawyer working here, which is great. And so over those last 27 years, the practice has really grown. And there's now, I want to say, 6 or 7 lawyers, some working full time, some working part time in the pro bono practice, which means that there's a lot of us to get work in, work with these nonprofits and international organizations and barristers chambers to help push forward work, because a lot of it is very collaborative. And so now we work to make sure there's enough pro bono opportunities for all of the lawyers that work in our UK and international offices. All of that is headquartered here in London. So it's a really, really exciting job, to be honest.
Yeah, and I can confirm what you're saying. Yasmin was actually like the first pro bono partner in Europe, because when I was doing when I was doing some research on this, I was like, oh, this is really, really, really cool.
It's very impressive.
Yeah. And I guess historically we see kind of pro bono culture embedded into law firms as more of kind of an American focus, but it's really nice to see in the past like 20, 30 years that this is something that's present in Europe as well. So, turning more to your role specifically, you work as a US qualified associate in Haug & Lovells. This is more of a
Yes.
technicality point, but you are US qualified. What does that mean? And does this affect the scope of your work?
Yeah, I mean, good question. So I'm not American. You can probably tell that from my accent. I'm from Glasgow. So I'm trying to think of my career. I think when I started working at Hogan Lovells, it was 2018. I started as a paralegal in a pro bono practice, and I decided that I wanted to get back into law after a few years working as a researcher. And so I was trying to figure out the best way to do that, really. And so I got a job as a paralegal here, thought, wow, the work here is really interesting, and fits with sort of my expertise in international law and human rights. So one of the options could have been to apply for a training contract and do, I know it's changed now, but do the GDL and ALPC. To be honest with you, I thought that that was, well, it was going to take a lot of time and it was also very expensive. And I thought, how else can I do this? So I knew a couple of people who had sat the New York bar and I looked that up and I realized I could study for that while working full time. I mean, it was horrible, but it was possible. So that's what I did. I decided I wanted to be qualified. And a lot of the work I do is in international law. So being qualified in England and Wales didn't matter so much. I would like to qualify here as well, but as a first step, to be honest, it was quicker, cheaper, and I was able to do it while still working full time. And so I sat and passed the New York bar and then got a role as an associate here. So, I mean, quite a bit of being in the right place at the right time as well, I would say.
And honestly, that sounds amazing. It's a bit more of an unconventional route, I think, into like law firms in London as well. And actually, on a more personal note, I'm so glad to hear your expertise is in international law, because
Yes.
that's where my interest lie as
So
well. And I,
interesting.
yeah, it's so interesting, and it's such a new field, and it's always changing. And I do international law as an optional module, and something that I want to take,
Amazing.
and something that I want to take further as well. Yeah, so I guess more about your day-to-day work as an associate in the pro bono department. What does that look like?
I mean, today's really busy. I think today is very like meeting heavy, which it can be like that. So I guess it's like a good scope of things actually I'm working on today. If we look at it as a typical day, I've had a call with clients this morning about an inquest that I'm working on, had a meeting with a partner to get them involved in a new project. Obviously speaking to you, which is wonderful. I've got a meeting about press that we're doing because we've got a big case coming up next week. And at the same time, I've got emails coming in on different projects and also areas where we're trying to work on. Because I think being a pro bono, a lot of it is you have to be working at the very cutting edge. Well, just things that are happening. So you mentioned earlier the war. So for example, when the Russian invasion happened, we had to work really quickly because people within the firm wanted to work on pro bono projects to do with that, understandably. So sometimes something like that can happen and it completely torpedoes what you were doing and you need to turn all of your attention to that. So my typical day, I would say, is sort of horizon scanning, seeing what's going on, trying to keep existing projects keep going, answer questions from lawyers within the firm on pro bono projects. And yeah.
Yeah, so moving on to one of the more like one of the actual cases you've worked on. So when I was preparing for this podcast, I came across on a piece in the Law Gazette actually that you were interviewed because of your
Yeah.
work in representing bereaved families in the Manchester Arena Inquiry, which for those who don't know concerns the terrorist attacks that happened at the end of an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester during 2017. Could you tell us a little bit about the case, what you're representing the families for, and also the legal claims that are involved?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, like you said, on the 22nd of May 2017, a bomb was detonated at the Manchester Arena. 22 people sadly lost their lives. And we have the privilege of representing six families who lost their loved ones. So they either lost their child, their mother, or their wife, respectively. The public inquiry began as a set of inquests. So whenever there is a violent unexplained death, an inquest will be opened. So inquests were opened into their deaths. We've previously worked on, now I didn't personally work in the 7-7 inquest because that was quite a long time ago, but we as a firm have worked in the 7-7 inquest, the inquest into the Westminster attack and the London Bridge Borough Market attack as well. So we do have a history of working on this. The inquests were opened. Then because of COVID and the trial of the bomber's brother, it kept getting put off. It got converted into a public inquiry because the chair, Sir John Saunders, he wanted to be able to hear evidence from the security service and the counter-terrorism police in closed hearings. So we don't know the detail of that. As the family's representatives, we got a gist of that evidence. So that's why it's a public inquiry. It opened in September 2020. And the hearings finished in March of last year. And we have had two reports published from the chair. So over the, oh gosh, how long was it? About 18 months, I think, altogether, the hearings. Over the 18 months of hearings, we heard from hundreds of witnesses. I can't remember how many documents were disclosed, but over 20,000, I think.
Wow.
Huge, huge case. So we heard from the emergency services who were there on the night. We heard from the people who provided security at the arena. We heard from associates of the bomber. We're meant to hear from another brother of the bomber, but he did not turn up. And we heard from educational establishments. It delved into so many areas about what happened before the attack, on the night itself, and what could have been done to prevent it, preventability issues. So we've had two reports from the chair. One was on safety and security at the arena. We've had a report on the emergency response on the night. And next week, the last report will be published, which is on preventability, radicalisation, what the security services knew, what more they could have done. And the purpose of a public inquiry is it's fact-finding, really. So it's not meant to be adversarial. But the families are represented. All of the other agencies are core participants. They're all represented legally. So they get to ask questions of the witnesses, whether that be representatives of the fire service, could be representative of MI5, could be an individual. We get to ask questions of them and try to establish what happened and ultimately what can be done to prevent something like this happening in the future.
Yeah, for sure. So you kind of differentiated from saying that it's not a trial, but it's a public inquiry. So I think that's something that maybe a lot of us may not necessarily be really familiar with. Could you tell us a bit more about the difference between the two and the implications it has for this case?
Yeah, absolutely. So the trial is a criminal process. So somebody will be put on trial and they're found guilty or innocent. And that is what happened to the bomber's brother. So he was sentenced to over 50 years in prison for his role in the attack. So I suppose there's accountability there in the criminal sense for the families to know that he's behind bars. The bomber himself died on the night. The public inquiry, it's a much wider scope. So the trial of the bomber's brother is just looking at his role in it, what he did, how he got involved, if he had a role in making the bomb, things like that. It's quite narrow. The public inquiry can take into consideration a lot more evidence. And it also takes into consideration documents from the families as well. So the families are meant to be at the heart of such a process. It's really for them to get answers, to establish exactly what happened, and so that public agencies can learn from what happened. I think there's a lot more learning in a public inquiry than there is perhaps in a criminal trial, where it's focused on one person. This is about everyone who was involved. And we have sections such as pen portraits as well, where each family was able to read out a statement, show photos, show videos of their loved ones who they lost, to make sure that they're at the front and centre. So it's less actually about the people who committed this terrible crime and more about the people who lost their lives.
That's really insightful. And I think it's really important to kind of even have those differentiations, because a lot of the times when things like this, terrorist attacks happen, there's a very strong focus on the criminal proceedings, on making sure the perpetrators are accountable. But at the same time, victims and families and friends of people, the victims that are affected, are kind of put to the wayside. And so it's really great that something like this is happening, though it's really devastating that it has had to come to this point. A lot of this is all very high profile in nature, which obviously adds a different dimension, which is the media angle. And this might not be present in some of the other smaller cases, for instance. Does this bring particular challenges, or does it make things easier, or both?
I think working on Manchester, that's definitely been the most sort of high profile case I've worked on, where you had the media in the court every day. And when you had certain evidence that would be on the news that day, and there's a lot of, obviously a lot of public interest in what was going on. I think that made it difficult sometimes for our clients, because it's constantly on the news and they can't really forget about it. For us, we haven't made that. Myself and other colleagues who work on this, we haven't, you know, been on TV giving interviews about it. We're really led by our clients and what they want to do. So they absolutely call the shots. But I think it's good in some ways, because where there are certain areas where we think, well, that's disgraceful, that's not in evidence, the media have been really good at portraying it and shining a light on it and making sure people know about it. And with You Can Advise Project, we try to get that out to as many people as possible, because we wanted people to know about it so that they would get in touch and ask for advice and ask for information. So I think that can be useful. It's all just about responsible media reporting, I would say. And so I've been lucky to work, I'd say, with the journalists I've worked with. They have been very responsible, very knowledgeable. I mean, some of them have been working on a certain area for tens of years. So they know a lot, and they can say, oh, that actually links back to this case. You can have really interesting discussions as well. We have a dedicated press team here at Hogan Lovells, so we work with them to make sure that we're all sort of lined up, I guess, in our approach.
Wow, that's really interesting, seeing it as how like lawyers doing pro bono are interacting with other professions like journalists and other departments within Hogan Lovells as well. What kind of other people do you work with?
We work with politicians sometimes. I'd say internally, each of our projects is led by a partner. So we have a supervising partner for every matter. So we work a lot with the partners within the firm as well, to try and get them involved and make sure we're using their expertise or areas of interest. Who else do we work with? Journalists, other lawyers, I suppose. So on Manchester, the bereaved families are represented by 5 different legal groups. So there's a lot of crossover. So we did a lot of work with those other solicitors firms and barristers. I mean, we work with barristers, lots of different barristers, chambers, just building up relationships. A lot of them do fantastic work pro bono, and it's, you know, they have such expertise, fantastic drafting skills. I mean, amazing advocacy skills, which they, you know, they deploy for free. So we're always very grateful to them as well.
That's amazing. And it's really nice that you really get to work with a range of people. Are there any other interesting cases that you've worked on and or are currently working on that you wouldn't mind sharing?
So we did a lot of work on reparations. That's been an area that I've been involved with since I started working at the firm. So we represent a group of Yazidi women who were enslaved by ISIS in Syria and Iraq. And we've been trying to get reparations for them for the crimes that were committed against them. And we have gone through the Australian domestic system, and now we're making an application to the UN Committee Against Torture, because they were enslaved by a foreign fighter from Australia. So we're making the case that they should be awarded reparations from Australia. And in tandem with that, we've done a lot of policy work. We've published 2 reports called Finance for Restorative Justice, looking at the current framework for how reparations are awarded to victims of international human rights abuses, and also advocating for a new way of financing that. So looking at frozen assets, seized assets, and fines from breaches of sanctions regimes. So that's been really interesting. That has been going on for years. And that's an area where we get to work with individuals, NGOs, politicians, international organizations, other lawyers, on the sort of advocacy front. So different to specific casework, but definitely linked. I think it can be quite novel as well with international law. The only thing is it moves very slowly. Like, obviously, because you're trying to get so many countries to agree, I guess. But you can be quite novel with it, which is what I enjoy about it.
So kind of what we were saying at the beginning is that we hope students and all of you listening today will really be able to see that pro bono is something that anyone can get involved with, whether you're a law student, a solicitor, a barrister, a trainee, a pupil, an in-house counsel, legal academics, whoever you are, and as long as you're involved in the legal profession in some sort of way, you can get involved. And as pro bono officer, I would tell you that you should definitely get started with university law societies, since they're student run. They're definitely not as like structured and big as, for instance, like what a pro bono practice would be like at a commercial firm, but there is still a lot of opportunities to be found there. Then there's obviously legal clinics and charities in the UK. So if you're interested, going to LawWorks and lawcareers.net, who have pro bono pages of kind of opportunities that are involved. But I think maybe a less obvious way to get involved with pro bono is actually by joining a relevant lawyers association. So Hayley, I know you are an executive committee member of the Human Rights Lawyers Association here in the UK. Could you tell us a bit more about what this association is, what they do, and who can join?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I have been a member of the, I think I've been a member for many years, and I've been a member of the executive committee for, I think, 2 years. And before that, I was a member of the Young Lawyers Committee of the HRLA. So that's how I got involved in the first place. So they are an association of human rights lawyers across the UK. And it's meant to be an area where we can work. So we try and bring together expertise so we can help anyone who wants, for example, like if you look at the Bill of Rights bill, we'll have a look into that. We'll do summaries and then we can give that expertise to other people. We host a lot of events. So I hosted an event here at Hogan Lovells with the HRLA last year with Nazanin Zaghari Radcliffe and Redress, looking at her case when she was imprisoned in Iran. But we've done recent events on disability rights, education law. We have a wide range of people here, members who work on different areas of human rights law, which is really interesting. And we also try and support young people, young human rights lawyers, students who want to undertake human rights work, who want to do human rights internships. We have an essay competition, the Young Lawyers Committee hosts a careers day every year. We have a bursary for internships that you can apply for. So I think we do have quite a focus actually on young lawyers or students who have an interest, who want to learn more about it. Because I know when I was younger, I mean, human rights, it's such a wide area. It's not one thing, right?
For sure.
So when I was younger, I thought, what does this mean? How do you get into it? I don't really understand. So I think a lot of our work is trying to explain what it is, showing the different options and trying to advocate for human rights lawyers in the UK.
I love that. And I think, to be honest, for me, a lot of pro bono is actually about increasing accessibility to the legal profession itself. So it's wonderful to see like you guys doing this kind of work. And for students, I think not only do you get access to these events and membership, and I think more importantly, even most importantly, you get to meet so many lawyers that are kind of a couple years or even more ahead, and you're able to ask them and network with them and really just get advice about what you want to do and maybe gain a bit more clarity, which I think would be invaluable for all university students. So you mentioned an essay competition and a bursary. Could you just tell us a little bit more about those specifically?
Yes. So I don't know what the dates are this year. So basically we have a young lawyers committee, and that's made up of students, trainees, pupils, just young human rights lawyers. And I'd say there's maybe 10 to 12 people on that committee. And they do a lot of fantastic work. I remember having a really good time when I was on that committee. And so there is an essay competition that we host every year, and there's a specific topic is given, and we'll have a date for when the submissions are in. And they're reviewed by members of the executive committee. committee, and we usually have a judge as well looking over it, and somebody is given a prize. So the best essay gets a prize on whatever that human rights topic is. There's a mooting competition as well. I forgot that. There is a mooting competition where, again, all of this information should be on our website. I would sign up for emails as well if you become a member. So if you sign up, it doesn't cost anything and you get access to these opportunities. It's a mooting competition as well, where I think the final last year was at the Royal Courts of Justice, which is really cool. Yeah,
right by LSE too.
And then we have the Careers Day. So that's hosted. We try and do it. I remember the year we did it was in person at Goldsmith University. Hogan Lovells has helped to host it before as well, virtually, where we'll have different panels. And I think that's really useful because, again, you can hear about the careers of different people working in human rights law, how they got into it, what they do now, and sort of practical matters as well.
Yeah. Amazing. So, for those that didn't catch it, basically just go to Google, search Human Rights Lawyers Association, click on the website, and you'll be able to sign up for free. So you have no reason not to sign up.
There we go. Yes.
There we go. I also want to take the time for those of you listening to mention that there are actually other similar lawyers associations. So it's not just the Human Rights Lawyers Association. So one of the lawyers associations that's also quite similar is actually a Young Legal Aid Lawyers. They're more age specific in the sense that even more focused on young lawyers that want to work in legal aid, and they have a lot of kind of similar opportunities as well. There's also associations like the Charity Law Association, the Environmental Law Association, the Constitutional Law Association, the Employment Law Association. You name it, you can find it. So I think we've been speaking a lot today about a lot of different topics. So if students, hopefully, if they're sold that doing pro bono work is an amazing thing to do and they want to undertake a career path that's similar to yours in the human rights and public interest law kind of spheres, what advice would you give to them?
I'd say try and figure out what it is exactly that you are interested in. So I did a master's in international law and security. So that was international criminal law, international human rights law, international humanitarian law, and realized that that's what I really did have an interest in. So I started applying to different organizations that worked in those areas for internships. But a lot of the time through your legal clinics, like you said, you might be able to get involved in some actual casework. I would say just keep up to date with developments. Honestly, I've curated, I would say, my Twitter in such a way that I feel like I can keep on top of not all the updates, but a lot of what's going on in the specific areas that I work in human rights. And reach out to people as well. People are very welcome to reach out to me on LinkedIn and chat. But yeah, talk to people, get involved in these associations, just try and get out there as much as possible. If there are essay competitions, get involved in that. Just develop those skills that you're going to need as a lawyer.
I think human rights is an area that a lot of people go into law school thinking, oh, I really want to do that. And then on the other end, it's kind of lost. But it's really nice to see that there are still people, and definitely a lot of students would be still be interested in that. Even if you go into a commercial firm, actually, there are still a lot of opportunities for you to undertake this area of law and this kind of work. But for students, for instance, that are exclusively looking to take the commercial law path, so doing the SQE now and then a 2-year training contract, what is the relevance of pro bono to them, and why should they still undertake this work?
I mean, I would say do it because it's interesting. You can give back to the community. You can get involved with real people and have your own clients. You actually get quite a lot of responsibility, I would say, doing pro bono as a trainee, which you might not necessarily get in your fee earning work, depending on your practice area and what cases are on. And there's a real variety of tasks that you can get involved in. It really just opens up your opportunities and maybe lets you see what else is going on. So yeah, societal benefits, business benefits, and personal benefits. I think it's, you know, really good for your own personal growth to do pro bono, although I would say that. But yeah, I think it just keeps things interesting.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you summed it up, all the reasons why you should do pro bono really well. So I will leave it at that. Is there any last words you want to say?
There's a lot to be done. I would say there's a lot of societal challenges, so we need as many of you as possible working on these issues. So don't be scared. Do it.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning into this episode of On the Case, the LSC Law Society's podcast. Further information and our contact details can be found in the description of this episode. Don't forget to follow us at LSCSU Law Soc on Instagram or on LinkedIn at LSC's On the Case. See you next time!